B-Pod Studios.
Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, the guy using your member number at the snack bar, Charlie Nance.
Hey, welcome back. Once again, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT underscore golf guy, and this is a week of looking back as we get ready for next week's United States Open Championship at Pebble Beach. We'll begin with Ron Cyrak of ronsyrak.com and the Golf Channel to fully recap the Women's U.S. Open from last week in Charleston. Then we'll visit with our friend, North Carolina amateur golfing legend Scott Harvey, about his recent win in the USGA Amateur Four-Ball Competition out at Bandon Dunes, and we'll wrap things up talking about Patrick Cantlay, the Memorial, and next week's national championship with Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer. So let's get started with Ron Cyrak and the United States Women's Open. Ron, let's start with the venue itself, the Country Club of Charleston. I have played it. I think it's a magnificent course. I applaud the USGA for branching out a little bit where the women are concerned and going to some new and unique places. What were your thoughts about the venue? What were the players' thoughts about the venue?
Yeah, I totally agree. And the USGA has done a good job of having a mix for the Women's Open between hidden gems like the Country Club of Charleston and a few years ago, Lancaster Country Club, and then these iconic places like Oakmont, and down the road they got the Olympic Club and Pebble Beach coming up. I love the golf course. The players love the golf course. They all thought it was a very, very challenging second-shot course, and that's absolutely true. The fairways are very generous, and the greens are very big, but you got to be in the right place in the fairway. You got to be on the right spot on the greens. And if you miss the greens, the up and downs were really hard. I think the players totally were in love with the place and thought that it was more than a major championship test.
You know, I didn't hear the vetching from the women's players in the Open that I do from the men. It doesn't matter who set up the course or how great it is. The men find a way to complain about it and gripe. And I can only imagine the men having to play the number 11 hole at Country Club of Charleston. They would have never shut up about it. But the women are just like accepting, like, this is the course we're going to play. It's magnificent. And they go on with it. I mean, how do you reconcile that?
You know where you also saw that? Early in the year when the new rules went into effect, all of the complaining came from the PGA Tour, and none of it came from the LPGA. And the irony there is one of the rule changes, the caddies not being able to line up players, was instituted because it was very common on the LPGA. And the first two penalties that were called were on the PGA Tour. It's the overall sense of entitlement that the women are still playing for one-fifth the prize money of the men, and they really don't feel like anything is owed to them. And they go out there and they just say, okay, this is what we got to play this week. Let's play it. And it is really refreshing and nice to hear the lack of complaints that you hear out there.
Ron Cyrak of ronsyrak.com and the Golf Channel is our guest taking today. We're talking about the United States Women's Open last week held in Charleston. The support from the community. I heard conflicting reports. Some people said it was very well attended and everyone was happy. Other people felt like it was sparsely attended. What was your vibe in terms of the community support of the tournament?
Well, the community was totally, both the city of Charlotte, the city of Charleston and the Country Club of Charleston were thrilled to have the event there. I think that the attendance was a little bit less than they thought it was going to be because it was brutally hot and humid there. I mean, it was, 97 early in the week. It moderated to about the low 90s on the weekend. But I think the weather kept some people away. But in terms of pride for having the event in their town, the town and the club completely embraced the event.
I just hope the USGA doesn't sour on doing things like this because, I would hate for a great hidden gem like the Country Club of Charleston for this to be a one-off just because the USGA felt like the community didn't support it, whereas, it was a new thing for them.
I think that they will go back there. I know when they played Lancaster Country Club in 2015, they set the Women's U.S. Open attendance record at 135,000 for the week, and I know they are going back there, and in part because the players love the golf course and the community embraced it so much. I think USGA was more than happy with the response that they got in Charleston.
Ron, what do you think the USGA's feeling is as far as the support they're getting from their television partner, Fox? I only bring that up. The ratings were fairly stagnant. They were up a little bit, but still at a 0.6 as I looked at them today. But I feel like the U.S. Women's Open, ever since Fox had it, almost takes place in anonymity. And, you know, look, CBS has the Masters, but the Golf Channel's all over the Masters, too. You know, same thing with the U.S. Open. You know, the Golf Channel doesn't ignore that. The Open Championship. I just feel like that Fox has somewhat alienated the other partners that could be helping them publicize this event. Was that part of the deal? Is the USGA happy with that?
Well, you know, Golf Channel is there. They have a presence, not anywhere near the presence that they're going to have next week at the Men's U.S. Open, where they'll do their live from on site the entire week. But you know, I don't know if either of the partners foresaw this, but part of the bind that Fox is in is they don't do enough golf to get better at what they're doing, you know?
Right.
The USGA events are the only events that they have. So they don't get better at developing a chemistry between the production people and the on-air talent and the chemistry between the people on air. And they certainly don't do enough women's events to know what they're talking about sometimes. In the times when I would hear some things on the broadcast, I would hear things that just were incorrect. At one point on Sunday, they mentioned that Lexi Thompson's caddy was Benji Thompson, her brother.
Well, he was at home watching.
Benji Thompson, but it wasn't her brother. So.
Yeah, I saw the tweet where her brother said, "Hey, just to let you know, I'm her brother, and I'm home watching right now. I'm not on the bag, just to let you know."
Oh. Yeah, So that is, you know, and I remember last year they said that Aria Jutanagarn's nickname is May because she won three tournaments in May. Well, she did win three tournaments in May at one point, but I've known her 7 years, and she's been called May since she was a little kid. You know, it was just entirely just an incorrect fact out there. So that's a problem, and it's a tough week. Look, they were going up against a Memorial tournament that had Tiger Woods in the field for TV ratings. That makes it a challenge also.
Ron Cyrak of ronsyrak.com and the Golf Channel is our guest taking Dead Aim. I guess I bring that up because when I was flipping back and forth, and I found myself staying a lot more with the Women's Open than I did the Memorial, just because I was blown away by some of the shot-making that was being done. I'll make you an argument right now that Jessica Korda hit the best golf shot I've seen this year. I don't care what tour you're talking about, on Saturday when she went driver off the deck to the par 5 from 267 and knocked it to 9 feet. And I just had this feeling of if a tree falls in the forest and no one's there to see it, you know, it was stunning to me.
Yeah, you know, I mean, Jessica's driver off the deck is one of my favorite shots. I mean, man, she hits it all the time. She has total confidence and faith in it, and I for the life of me, I don't know how. I come from a generation. I'm old enough to have played clubs when you could hit a driver off the deck.
I don't know how you hit. Look, I have Jessica's driver. I don't know how she hits that off the deck.
Yeah, I don't know how you can hit a 460cc driver off the deck, but she does it. There was a lot of astounding shot making there. I saw some up and downs that were just. They were just unbelievable, and that is the problem. And you know, I know I've said this to you before. To me, the biggest critics of the women's game, both among fans and among the media, are people who don't go to the tournaments and don't watch the tournaments. Once you experience it, you realize how great the product is. And I'll tell you the other thing that's happening in women's golf. And I've been talking with the people at Golf Channel about the need for us to do something about it. Is the distance explosions come in the women's golf. The last I checked, There's 12 women averaging over 280 off the tee right now, and Van Dam's leading the tour, averaging 291. I think the women's game is transitioning to a point to where I don't think you can hit a 245, 250 and win anymore. If you look at who the top players are, Jutana Garn and Sung Hyun Park and Lexi Thompson and Brooke Henderson, they don't kill the ball. They just hit it a long ways. Jung-un Lee, six, who won the tournament, was eighth in the field in driving distance and 11th in accuracy, fifth in greens in regulation. Those are overall strong stats, but it's becoming a power game out there.
You know, one thing that I found interesting watching the tournament over the weekend, and I think this happens more in the ladies' game, or maybe it's just my imagination. You'll have to straighten me out on this. Occasionally in a men's major, you'll see someone you've never heard of before pop up and have a great day one or day two, but very rarely do they hang into the weekend. Whereas in the women's game, you'll have these ladies pop up and lo and behold, they'll hang in there till the very end. And like for instance, Celine Boutier, I had never heard of Celine Boutier until this weekend, and she was there right up until the very end.
Yeah, I thought that was another point about the field that Fox was missing on Sunday. There was some shaky golf played early on Sunday, and they pointed out that there was some bad golf being played, and they used the term bad golf more than I thought they should. But what they didn't point out, there were only two people on the first page of the leaderboard, Lexi Thompson and So Young Yoo, who had any even remote experience being on a stage that big. You look at the top. Yu Liu and Celine Boutier and Jae-Marie Greene and these were all people who hadn't been in that situation, but it shows you how deep the talent is out there right now. It's a global tour. 33 different nations are represented in LPGA membership, and as it's broadened, the depth of talent is just getting more and more and more. It used to be if you went to an LPGA tournament, you could write down 20 or 30 names, and the winner was going to be one of those people. You can't do that anymore. We've now had the last 11 U.S. Opens have been won by 11 different players. The last eight different LPGA majors have been won by eight different players. That's the parity that's come to that tour.
We'll get back to some of the talent in a minute. Ron Cyrak of ronsyrak.com and the Golf Channel, our guest taking Dead Aim. I would be remiss if I didn't bring up the shadow that fell over the first part of this U.S. Women's Open, which I thought was just sickening. And those were the comments of Hank Haney on his radio show, which were just so irresponsible and so, I don't know, there's no other word than just offensive. I thought that the players, and I hate to use this term, took it well. I almost wish there would have been more outrage, but they handled it with so much class and dignity. But I felt so bad for the girls, because there is really some great golf being played by some outstanding golfers on the LPGA Tour. And for someone in his position and his experience to be so ignorant, I guess I shouldn't be stunned anymore. But were you stunned?
I was stunned. And in fact, Thursday morning, I went on Golf Channel and they asked me, what did you think of Hank Haney's comments, and I just sort of blurted out, I don't know which appalled me more, the bigotry of the comments or the stupidity of the comments.
Yes.
Because here's my bottom line. I've got a 5 to 7 minute spot I do every Monday morning on Morning Drive for Golf Channel. I'll put 2 hours of prep time into the 5 to 7 minutes, because that's my job. I'm supposed to know what's going on. To be somebody who's paid to go on the radio and talk about golf and to say, I don't know where the U.S. Women's Open is being played this week and I can't name six players in the field, is irresponsible. You're being paid to be better than that. You're being paid to know about golf. And to be involved as an instructor in the game and to alienate 50% of the population, to alienate all the women who play the game of golf, is not a very it's not a way to grow the game, you know. So to me, I did not get And besides, his comments also were not informed. If you want to have a discussion about the globalization of the women's game, that's a discussion worth having. If you want to have a discussion about the success and the level of success of Korean women's on the LPGA, that's a discussion worth having. But to go about it in the way he did, I can't think of anybody's name, is just not acceptable.
Ron, I want to talk with you about a couple of names that were on the leaderboard that made me smile to see them there. Lexi Thompson had a very good tournament. She's going to be kicking herself for her Sunday round. But I thought she not only hit the ball outstanding. She was putting with a brand new grip, the claw grip. I thought it looked good and looked smooth coming off her putter. More than that, I saw Lexi Thompson smile throughout the tournament. She appeared to be enjoying being in her own skin, which is progress based on what we've seen and heard over the last several months.
Yeah, I wrote a column which you can find if you go to my Twitter account. I tweeted out a link to it. I think I just retweeted it today, but I tweeted out a link saying 2 years ago, Lexi would not have been mentally prepared to deal with the way this tournament came out for her because it was there. She for the first 3 days. Her ball striking was awesome, was off the charts. Her putting was mediocre. And then sort of the ball striking collapsed under the weight of mediocre putting on Sunday. But the fact is what she's gone through in the last 2 years, start with that four-stroke penalty at the 2017 ANA that cost her a major championship, go through her mother's battle with uterine cancer, take her through the missed two-foot putt at the end of the 2017 season, and then go up into when she took a month off in the middle of last year, skipping the Women's British Open, to start working with a therapist. And you know, she is amazingly honest. She said, since I was 12 years old, golf's been my life. You know, I've lived in the spotlight. And she's been working very, very hard to not let golf be the sole determining factor as to whether she's a happy person or not. And I noticed the smiles that you noticed. I think that she's in a very, very good place right now, and I think it's all going to lead to more great golf from her down the road.
The stunning stat of the week to me was Lexi Thompson is 24 years old and was playing in her 13th consecutive Women's Open.
Yep.
I just shook my head at that and went, that is unbelievable. A couple of the names I want to ask you about before we get out of here. I was very pleased to see Jarena Pillar have such a great finish, especially in a Solheim Cup year. I love Jarena Pillar. I thought she was great. And also, this was the first tournament for two amateurs, well, now they're professionals, I guess, who captured our fancy at the first annual Augusta National Women's Amateur, and that was Jennifer Kupcho and Maria Fassi. Lo and behold, Maria Fassi has a top 15, and I find her to be one of the most charismatic girls to come out on tour in a long time.
I'll go out on a limb and I'll say it right now that Maria Fassi is going to be a star. I think she's got not only the talent to be a great player, but I think she wants to be a great player. More than Lorena Ochoa was never comfortable in the spotlight. An early Annika Sorenstam wasn't comfortable in the spotlight and had to learn how to be comfortable in the spotlight. But you get the sense with Maria that she is, you know, she says, bring it on. Plus, she's another one of those players who absolutely crushes the golf ball.
Yeah.
And she plays an exciting brand of golf, a power game. And I think that mentally she is ready with everything that comes along with being a star, and I expect her to be a star.
From RonCyrak.com and the Golf Channel, that's Ron Cyrak, a past recipient of the PGA of America's Lifetime Achievement Award in Journalism. And up next, North Carolina amateur golfing legend Scott Harvey takes dead aim at his latest USGA title in the Amateur Four-Ball Championship, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.
are Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Scott Harvey is one of my favorite people in golf. He's the son of a North Carolina golfing legend, Bill Harvey, and in his own right has won the United States Golf Association's mid-amateur title, finished runner-up in the same, was a member of a Walker Cup team, and as of a couple of weeks ago with his partner, won the USGA amateur four-ball out at Bandon Dunes. Well, let's start with this. You played a couple of kids in the finals from ECU, Blake Taylor, Logan Shipping, and there's a part of you, Scott, that has to look in the mirror and then look at who's on the tee box with you and say, what am I doing here? I got socks older than these two guys.
Yeah. Not really. You know, I tell you what. Here's what I know. The golf ball has no clue how old I am. as long as I make contact, that ball's going to go. If I put it where it needs to go, it age makes no difference to me.
You know, my friend, I remember lamenting the demise of the USGA Pub Links Championship because, sort of like the Mid-Am, it was the amateur championship for the everyday golfer who was no longer, yep. You know, and I hated when they did away with it, but then I was intrigued by the concept of the four ball. How many of the four balls have you and your partner competed in?
We've played in every single one of them. So actually, I just learned that this past one, there's only two teams that have done that, Nathan Smith and Todd White, and then my partner Todd Mitchell and myself. I played in all five, and pretty excited about it because it's extremely hard to qualify for.
Now, I'm not going to dog out Nathan and Todd, but they actually look at you guys and say they got socks older than you.
Well, Nathan and myself and Todd are the same age, but Todd White, he's got to be 51 or so, maybe, I think.
He's like a metronome. That clock just keeps ticking down the middle of the fairway.
He can still play, though.
All right, let's talk about the qualifying for this. The USGA is notorious for their local, regional, sectional, biennial qualifying. What is the qualifying process to do the four ball each year?
All right, so it's a bit of a crapshoot. You have one day, 18-hole best ball, and that's it. And that's like, you know, anything can happen in best ball anyways, but when you just throw an 18
holes,
you're taking basically two teams, or two spots, I should say, at each qualifier. Some of them just have one, but we seem to have two everywhere we've been. And, you know, like I said, 18 holes, best ball is like total crapshoot, lightning in a bottle kind of thing. You either get it going or you don't. And we've been fortunate enough to get it going every time. There was one time I can tell you we turned at one under after the front nine, looked at the leaderboard, and we were five shots out of the off the cut or whatever to make it. And we looked at each other and said, "This is not acceptable."
Wow!
And that doesn't mean it's going to happen, but we were fortunate enough to make it happen. And like I said, we've been playing in all of them, and it's the most fun tournament that we each play in every year. We say it each time. It's just so much fun to share everything with each other, and just, you know, the team experience is not something you get enough of in golf, right?
Well, and not only that, but this is something that we all do on a weekly basis. We all play four ball all the time, and so this is something that I think, you know, I talk about the Pub Links and the Mid-Am being the everyman championships. This is the everyman format. This is what we all play.
Yep. It's something everybody's used to, but then you throw it in on the USGA, running a national event at a world-class venue, and then you throw in, you know, match play, and it's just unbelievable. The experience is unbelievable.
We're talking with Scott Harvey, former mid-amateur champ, mid-amateur runner-up, Walker Cupper, and now USGA four-ball champion. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. So you qualify, and then that you were top two, so then that gets you out to Bandon. I would think when you're starting this process and you're looking, well, where are we going to play this year, and you see Bandon Dunes, dude, how cool is that?
Yeah, you know, we saw the schedule. They usually put it out a couple years in advance. You can kind of see where the next couple years are going to be. And we saw Bandon and got a little excited. I've never been out there. It's one of those places, if you're a golfer, you just kind of want to go to, right? You just you don't just stumble upon Bandon. It's like
you got to make a point to go to Bandon.
Yeah. So, but my partner had been out there before, and Pacific Dunes, which was we played one round of stroke play there. That's his favorite course in all the world. So I know he wanted it really bad, and that's all I hear about. And I'm like, man, all right, I got to go see this place. And like I said, we were thrilled when we got there. And I'll give you a quick story. The final four, so the semifinalists all get 1 year exemption, for the next year. And so we made it to the semis, and we were so excited that we didn't have to qualify for next year's event at Philly Cricket Club, and because neither one of us had been there, and not to mention you just don't have to qualify, right? Because who knows if you're going to actually do it. And then we won that match and made it to the finals, and we're like, oh yeah, we got 3 years now. We don't have to qualify. And then we win, and it's like, oh, my God, we got 10 years. It's just awesome.
Wow, so that's the price. You get a 10-year exemption into the actual tournament itself?
Yes, sir.
Wow, that is awesome.
That'll take us right to, like, 50 years old.
Then who knows what you're going to be into. Scott Harvey is our guest taking Dead Aim. So you get out to the Bandon Dunes, and there's several courses. There's Old Mac, there's Pacific Dunes, there's Bandon Dunes, and there is a medal play portion before you get to the match play. How many holes of medal play did you have to have?
Two, just like U.S. Amateur, two rounds of stroke play, and the top 32 teams instead of 64 like U.S. Amateur. The top 32 teams advanced to match play. And, you got to play some golf because high-level competition, 32 is not really that many if you start thinking about it. And, we were able to play. We actually had some really bad weather in our first round of stroke play, but played really well, really solid, and made it through. And then in match play, is like, strap on and get with it because it's tough.
I got to tell you, I was somewhat surprised at how low the scoring was for 36 holes of medal play. I don't care which track you're playing out there. None of those courses would you, on any given day, describe as an easy golf course, especially when you get the wind involved out there. Were you somewhat surprised that, I think you guys shot 10 under for two rounds, but 13 under, 12 under, 11 under?
Yeah, we were a little surprised because of the weather, but our first day was the worst weather. We had the late draw the first round and then early the second, and that was the tougher draw. And when we went out and shot, I can't remember, I think it was 6 under the first round, in the rain and wind, and it was just crazy. I mean, just everything was soaking wet and cold. And when we did that, I felt extremely good about our chances for the week because that was the weather was not going to get any worse than that. And we finished, I forget what number, we finished sixth or so in stroke play. And of all the teams that were up top, there was only one other team that had our same draw. So I just felt like we were playing as good as anyone. And so it played out to be that way.
North Carolina amateur golfing legend and current United States Golf Association four-ball champion, Scott Harvey, is our guest taking Dead Aim. Of all the years that you've competed in this, have you always made it to the round of 32, or have you sometimes not made it out of medal play?
No, we've made it. We've made match play every year. We made the final four, the semis, the very first one at Olympic Club.
And that was the one that Nathan and Todd won, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I actually had two buddies of mine from back home that beat us to get to the finals, and which was no offense to them. I mean, they're great players, but they played at a level that I had not seen out of them back home. and they beat us in extra holes, and then Nathan Todd beat him in the finals. And, that's twice now that three out of four guys in the finals have been from the Carolinas. So, great for the CGA there.
Absolutely. I want to ask you about the kids that you played in the finals, their teammates at East Carolina. I've talked with Blake before. Last summer he qualified, for the PGA Tour event up at Snead's place in West Virginia. Yeah. What were your thoughts about their game?
What nice people. The nicest guys we played all week. Great ball strikers, great putters. I couldn't be happier with, sometimes you play these college kids, and they can be a little cocky and arrogant, and it just rubs you the wrong way. Not these guys. They were extremely nice and respectful. And, you know, we talked afterwards. You know, their parents were there, caddying for them, and they had their families with them. And just a overall great experience. You know, and it was one of those deals where whoever came out on top, it was all going to be okay. There was not, you know what I mean? There was not going to be any hard feeling. And like, oh, I can't believe these guys beat me or whatever. Like, these guys were great players, great people, and I hope I get to run into them in the future, and all the best to them as well, because I think they got two bright futures at them.
Scott, would you say that the attitude in an event like this, I mean, granted, you're going to run into, you know, younger kids like you just pointed out, but for the most part, you've got guys who are, shall we just say, seasoned, mature men out there playing in this event. Do you find that the attitude that everyone has is pretty much, you know what, we're really glad to be here, and we're going to compete, and we're going to try to beat your brains in, but man, isn't this great to be out here? Everyone pretty much has a great attitude.
Pretty much. I think I've only, in all five of them that we've played in, I've really only come across one that I can remember now. Only one that I can remember that was just, I just didn't like them. I mean, they're just screaming, yelling, rude, obnoxious. And other than that, though, that's been the attitude. Everybody's extremely happy to be there. And like you said, want to beat our brains in and whatnot, which is fine because we want to beat their brains in too. But it's one of those, no matter the outcome, what a great experience kind of thing.
Scott Harvey, North Carolina amateur golfing legend, USGA four-ball champion, among his other credentials, is our guest taking dead aim. If memory serves, this is a Walker Cup year, is it not?
It is, yes. It is a Walker Cup year. Huh?
So what is your schedule for the rest of the summer?
You know,
because I know you took some time off.
Yeah, you know, I thought about changing it to get like – we had a baby. I got a 7-month-old baby at home, and I thought about going after it one more time. But I'm my kids. I got a 9-year-old and a 7-month-old, and you know we're going to do some things as a family this summer. And I'm just not going to go out there and run the gauntlet trying to make it again. I'm going to play in some tournaments, and if I play great and happen to do something really special and make the team, that's going to be that'd be awesome. But I'm not going to go out there and just run the whole gauntlet trying to do it anymore. I'm just not going to do it.
Do you have plans to try to compete in the Mid-Am this summer?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
I play in the Porter Cup, USAM. I play in the Mid-Am tournament out in L.A. Called the George Thomas. And I will play in the Transmiss. So, I mean, I've got four tournaments. And the Mid-Am is, I think, in October or something
right.
like that. I've got a handful of tournaments to play in, but I'm not trying to go about it like I did before.
Get you out of here, and this one, I ask about somebody. We swapped messages this weekend. One of my favorite stories in the last couple of years was the fireman from Massachusetts, Matt Parziali, playing in the Masters a couple of years ago. And then I looked on the longest day of golf the other day and saw that he had qualified for the U.S. Open. Parziali was out at Bandon Dunes with you. This is a really great guy, isn't he?
Oh, it's fantastic. We played our practice rounds together each day at Bandon. He's a close friend of mine. I pull for him every step of the way.
Folks, there's not a finer gentleman in the game than that guy right there, North Carolina amateur golfing legend Scott Harvey. And when we return, Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer takes dead aim at last week's Memorial and next week's U.S. Open, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.
We're taking dead aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Ron Green Jr. was on the beat for the Global Golf Post last weekend in Dublin, Ohio for the Memorial. Ron, let's begin with Patrick Cantlay. This guy For a lot of people who don't know, this was one of the can't-miss kids. By the time he was a sophomore at UCLA, he had already been ranked number one as an amateur longer than anyone had ever been ranked number one as an amateur. He had won the Hogan Award. He had won the Mickelson Award. He had won the Haskins Award. And he was a sophomore at UCLA. There was never a can't-miss kid. Even Tiger. I mean, this was the can't-miss kid coming out of UCLA. And just as fast, it just almost went completely away from him. I read in your piece this week in the Global Golf Post, it reminded me of Freddie Couples describing that moment in I guess it was 92 or 93, where he was on a range and he hit a shot and felt a knife go through his back. And the same thing happened with Patrick Cantlay. He hit a shot and it literally felt like a knife went through his back. And we'll get to the caddy situation in a minute. But basically, you go from being the can't-miss kid to can't get off my couch.
Yeah, I mean, and not just for a little while, for basically 3 years. And, I mean, whether it's Tiger, whether it's Freddie, whether it's any number of dozens and dozens of tour players through the years, I mean, there may be nothing scarier than a back injury, because obviously it affects everything you try to do in a golf swing. And in Cantlay's case, I mean, there he was. I mean, he was number one, the top-ranked amateur in the world for almost, say, 54, 55 weeks, the longest ever. And just sort of methodically going about his business, and everybody sort of knew where it was leading him. And then you hit the pause button, and he was telling us how many doctors he went to and various diagnoses he got about this or that. And finally, you know, felt like, you know, start one, then decide that may not be what he needed and go to something else. And so it took a while. Finally found something, stuck with it, and it worked. And he, you know, came back. And then in the midst of all that, in 2016, he and his, I guess, his best friend and caddy, Chris Roth, coming out of dinner in Manhattan Beach, suddenly a car runs over and kills his buddy. I mean, right in front of him. He's right there. There's nothing he could do. And, you know, he said, you know, when I got to him, I could tell, like, what had happened. And so not only do you have the physical scars and rehab from all that, suddenly you throw this whole, you know, gut-wrenching, life-changing emotional experience on top of it. And it's been a lot for him. I mean, he's, whatever, 27, I guess. And here he is now. You know, once he got back to golf, I mean, it didn't take him long. I mean, he had seven or eight events to regain his tour card through a medical exemption, and took him two times. And he got it, and off he went. He won last fall, had chances to win other things, had a chance to win the Masters this year. And so what we saw at Memorial sort of was the big step you've been waiting to see, or we've been waiting to see. And it's, you know, there's no sense that it's sort of a one-off with him. I mean, my list of five players to win the U.S. Open includes him, and that was done before he won the Memorial. I mean, he's finished third at the PGA and tied for ninth at the Masters. So he's a good hard course player. And as we know, the U.S. Open tends to be about hard courses.
Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer is our guest taking Dead Aim. Not only that, but in a lot of ways, he's become this generation's Charles Howell III. All this guy does, whenever he tees it up, and like Tiger, he's very smart about his back. He's not one of these guys that's going to be out there week in, week out. He's going to play 1 or 2 weeks, and then he's going to be off 1 or 2 weeks or 3 weeks. And he knows how to do this. But every time he goes out, Ron, it's a top 15. I mean, you can literally go to the pay window and say, I'm taking Cantlay to finish top 15, and you're going to make money every week.
Yeah, I mean, if you were investing in him, you were going to get the short-term payoff, and you're going to get the long-term payoff. He's sort of a no-nonsense guy. He's kind of stoic, keeps his distance. He's not warm and fuzzy. He doesn't interact with the crowd. I mean, that's just, as he said when he got quizzed about it Sunday night after winning, he said, you know, if I tried to do that, it'd come off as fake. He goes, that's who I am. He told a great story about just walking in Sunday morning, and somebody said, saw the look on his face, said, it can't be that bad. And he goes, you know, he said, I was actually happy. But he said, that's the way I look sometimes, and I don't mean anything by it. But I think for fans, he's the kind of guy they're probably just starting to learn about and warm up to, but get used to him, because he's going to be here. If that back holds up, he's going to be here for a long time.
You know, we mentioned how successful this guy was as an amateur, and he's a two-time winner on the PGA Tour and all the success he's had. But you also bring up the Masters. He eagles 15 in round four, and for the briefest of moments, his name is at the top of the leaderboard, and almost as quickly, he bogeys 16, and you could just see for someone, even with his experience and his pedigree of winning, that sometimes the moment still gets big for you when you're used to winning. And I found it almost refreshing that the moment was too big for him. But then he bounces back so fast. And Jack's tournament's a big tournament. And I think, like you said, he's a fairly good pick for the U.S. Open. I don't believe the big moment is going to overwhelm him very often.
No, I don't think so at all. And I think, you know, it's going to be about hitting fairways and hitting greens. And it's not a long golf course at Pebble Beach, and especially by today's standards, not long. But some of the tiniest targets they're going to face. And, you know, par becomes valuable in the U.S. Open. And he knows how to do it. And he's very efficient at what he does. He, I mean, he's plenty long enough, but he, you know, he doesn't play golf like Brooks Koepka plays. He plays the kind of golf that I think is built for major championships. And he said it Sunday night. I mean, he goes, the harder it is, the narrower it is, the firmer the greens, the better I like it. He said, I want you to make it as hard as you can, and I like my chances.
Tiger echoed those same comments about really going back to more of an old school USGA setup. Do you foresee that happening in the near future? And I say that because as we were watching the U.S. Women's Open last week, I absolutely adored the setup they had at the Country Club of Charleston. And it seemed to me for the first time ever, the USGA was not obsessed with par, and it made for a really good golf tournament.
I think we're going to get pretty much an old-school U.S. Open, I think, at Pebble Beach. And I think, you know, to a lot of growing up through the years watching the U.S. Open, if you just say, what do you think about when you think of the U.S. Open, what places do you think about? Pebble Beach is probably the one that comes first to mind. There's a bunch of those old northeastern courses with the giant oak trees, you know, the Wingfoots and Oakmont, which doesn't have the big trees much anymore. But at Pebble Beach, I mean, from Nicklaus hitting the one iron to Watson's chip in to Kite to Tiger to all those things. I mean, it's a beautiful marriage between the U.S. Open and Pebble Beach. And it feels like this is where the U.S. Open needs to be this year, because they've had a run where no matter what, you know, every year we keep writing, well, they can't afford another miscue. I mean, Chambers Bay was a nice idea that maybe didn't come off the way they want to. Same for Erin Hills, but you know, last year, Saturday afternoon at Shinnecock just turned silly. And I think they will work very hard not to let that happen again. I think they know how to set up Pebble Beach. I less than 7,100 yards. There's only so much they can do with it. And I think they're going to put the real premium on driving the ball in the fairway. And, you know, it's a joke growing up when I was younger, you'd say, you know, players used to have to walk single file down the fairways at the U.S. Open. And I think even at Shinnecock, they brought the fairways in last year, but they had decided originally to let them be so wide that, you know, even bringing them in, they were still 25 to 30 yards wide. I think, frankly, maybe the only defense for Pebble Beach will be, if the wind doesn't blow, will be narrowing it up and making, you know, if you hit it off the green or off the fairway, you're going to have to pay a penalty or at least a half a shot because, you know, there's a whole other discussion to be had there about the ball going so far. I mean, and when you got to Shinnecock where it could run out like that and other places, I mean, you know, you can't make it too long for players now. So I think this is a chance for them to get back to the old-style U.S. Open.
Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking Dead Aim. I criticized Tiger Woods. I know it disappointed a lot of people here in Charlotte. I really felt like he needed to play between the Masters and the PGA against the competition that's out there now. He can't just show up and expect to contend. That being said, there's a theory out there that he got a look at Bethpage Black and sort of realized that course may be actually too big for him at this point. You bring up 7,100 yards at Pebble Beach. Tiger played and played pretty well, especially the front nine on Saturday. Heading into the U.S. Open, I'm sure that he stuck his head in the media room. What was the vibe you got coming off of Tiger heading into the third major of the year? What was the sense of him and about his game?
Excitement. Encouragement. I mean, he said, my game is right where I need it to be going into Pebble. He hit it pretty well around Memorial, and that golf course is longer than it's going to be at Pebble Beach. And, you know, and had some pretty darn thick rough there. If you got it in the wrong spot, you saw plenty of players having to pitch it back out and get it in play. But I think he felt good about it. He said he feels better. He had lost a lot of weight by the time he got to the PGA. Wasn't feeling good there. You know, it took him a while to get over the joy kind of and the from emotional physical exhaustion from winning that Masters, which led them skipping Charlotte. But I think he is geared up, ready to go. I think if you were going to give him any place to try to go win another major outside of Augusta, this is the spot. Pebble Beach and him, I mean, he played the greatest golf tournament I'd ever played there 19 years ago. And granted, he came back there in 2010 and didn't win, but he knows what to do and how to do it. And I think it's not – we talk a lot about how he drives the ball, and he's driving it better than he has, but he doesn't have to hit driver more than four or five times probably there. And so – which you should correspond to him getting it in the fairway more often, and there's still not a better iron player out there than Tiger. So I look for him to be a factor there. I think he is very, very excited about this, and I think for good reason.
Ron, a player who seems to have been mired down a rabbit hole for a couple of years, especially last year, but I have seen some really good signs at Bethpage and last week heading into the U.S. Open. In fact, so much so that I looked at my son last week. He said, who do you think is going to win the U.S. Open? I said, you know, I'm going to take a flyer on this one. I've got a feeling about Jordan Spieth. He's been talking about how his game is close, and it just seems with Bethpage and then last week at Memorial, he just seemed right on the verge. And speaking of someone who's driving the ball better than I've seen him drive it in a number of years, it seems that he has finally gone back to embracing the little tight 5-yard draw that he had when he came out, and he looked really good to me.
Well, he's certainly getting there. I mean, three straight top tens after not having a top 10 finish in basically a year, I guess. I mean, it's hard to believe it's been almost 2 years since he's won a tournament, but I mean, he sort of fell out of the conversation for a while there, and now he's been arguing that he's getting closer and closer. And there's evidence there to prove it. Now, he didn't play well on Sunday when he needed to. I think he shot 73 at Muirfield. But he's putting himself in those positions again. He putts it really well. I mean, the putter came back a while ago. And, yeah, and we talk all the time about how much confidence matters. I mean, you can stand up there. You don't want to stand up there hoping you hit a good shot. You want to stand there knowing you're going to hit a good shot. And I think he's getting closer to that. I think he still hits the occasional foul ball, not the big foul ball, but it's not quite where it needs to be, and that could get him in trouble at a U.S. Open because you don't have to hit it in but one bad spot in, or two, as Dustin Johnson learned in 2010 out there at Pebble Beach when he made, suddenly he messes up, the first hole or second hole, I guess, and then hits it someplace you can't even imagine hitting it on the third hole and puts himself right out of the championship there. So, U.S. Opens tend to be so unforgiving, but I think, Jordan, and we know what he can do in major championships, he should be a factor there. I think 3 months ago, you wouldn't have thought so, but I think given what we've seen the last three tournaments he started, I'm buying him right now.
Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking Dead Aim. Before we touch briefly on the Canadian Open this week, one last question about Memorial. It's one of three tournaments that have always been identified with a singular player or person. There was the Byron Nelson, there was Arnie at Bay Hill, and there's Jack at Memorial. I think that what happened with the death of Byron Nelson and to his tournament is a cautionary tale that was taken to heart by the people at Bay Hill. I was really concerned about the future of that tournament once Arnold was not there, but it seems that tournament is on very solid footing. It's a morbid question, but do you sense that there is a plan in place if and when something happens to Jack for this tournament to continue and to continue to prosper and thrive?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't think Jack has any intention of going anywhere for a very, very long time. I think this one rolls on. I think what they've created there, combined with where it is on the schedule, combined with how much they like that golf course, I mean, it's a terrific tournament. It's in its own, it's not on the level of, it's not a major, obviously, and not quite a WGC, but to a lot of players, it means about as much. I mean, it has the added benefit of not just a 2-year exemption. If you win, you get 3 years there. I mean, they gave that to Jack and Arnie's tournaments to sort of elevate them further. There is a whole elevated feeling around the Memorial. Like, okay, this is one of the, if there are 12 events on the PGA Tour that really matter, this is one of them. I mean, and he's there and he's hands on and he's, you see him around and he's talking to players and he's, in the clubhouse visiting with people and all that. So, I think it's such a good place and it comes at such a good time on the schedule. I think it just keeps rolling along. I think, you know, I was surprised that you would think Dustin Johnson and Brooks Koepka would be there, but I mean, they're playing this week in Canada. They got the U.S. Open. I think they might be playing Travelers after that as some game. You know, there's some of it with the condensed schedule. Players are having to we're seeing it right now that it's squeezing some players, you know, this week or that week or the next week, trying to fit everything in. But I'm a huge fan of the Memorial. It's one of my favorite weeks. And I think if you go up there and you see it, you just can't help but like it. And I think that carries over to the players.
Get you out of here on this. The RBC Canadian Open is this week, and you talk about a tournament that's been affected by the schedule. I believe we're about 6 weeks earlier on the schedule than we normally would have been for the RBC Canadian Open. It normally comes after the week after the Open Championship at the end of July. If we were worried about a growing season in New York and upstate New York for the PGA, Canada had to be in a panic.
Well, I think they were delighted that they got put in the spot they did. I mean, this is, you know, for decades been one of the, you know, I mean, it's a national open. It's been a part of the PGA Tour. And, you know, famously the tournament, the big one, Jack never won. And it got relegated to being after the Open Championship, which didn't help it. And it just sort of got kicked around, bumped around. And, you know, the location has changed a little bit, but I think being put the week before the U.S. Open, it helped. And I mean, you got Dustin Johnson, you got Brooks Koepka, you got Justin Thomas, you got Rory McIlroy up there. I mean, that's a pretty good starting foursome for any tournament. So I think it's got a sort of a renewed energy to it. Look forward to seeing the place they're playing. And, you know, it's a perfect little run-up to U.S. Open, which, you know, it just feels like the whole year speeding by so fast. Here we are at the U.S. Open. There's only going to be one more major championship after that. You know, we're 2 months away from the playoffs and 2.5 months from the whole season being over. Hard to believe.
From the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, that's Ron Green Jr. Hey, I'd also like to thank North Carolina amateur golfing legend Scott Harvey and Ron Cyrak from ronsyrak.com and the Golf Channel, a past recipient of the PGA of America's Lifetime Achievement Award in Journalism, for their time and insight this week. A reminder, a great way to stay in the loop with us is to be a regular consumer of our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim, featured there right now. Our links to articles on Fox's upcoming high-tech presentation of the U.S. Open and a terrible decision, in my opinion, made by the USGA. I guess the latest in a long line there. Weather-wise, okay, let's try to be positive and say sketchy at best this weekend in the Carolinas to find a way to tee it up and let this game continue to haunt your soul and break your heart. But if you do put a peg in the ground, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep it in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter @CLT_golf guy, and I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.